Welcome to Disruptive Adventism. My name is Jose Briones, and I'll be your host for this podcast. This podcast is about discussing the polemical statements and practices that are part of the Adventist fabric, which in turn shape this belief system to be unique and relevant for today's society. During today's podcast, we continue our coverage on Annual Council by discussing some of the votes that the delegates will be taking on this year's meetings. We hope that you enjoy this podcast, and with nothing else to say, let us begin. Welcome everyone to another episode of Disruptive Adventism. We're continuing our coverage of Annual Council, and today we're going to be discussing a couple of the votes or things that are being recommended to the Executive Committee, which is the whole group of administrators that come and that meet in these couple of meetings for the next couple of days. We have Dr. Nicholas Miller with us. He is a professor of church history at the Theological Seminary in Andrews University, and he is also a lawyer working for the Lake Union Conference. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Miller.
Happy to be here, yes.
Before we start, we always try to get a little bit of background, so tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you enjoy doing, and what are some of the projects that you're involved in right now?
Well, I like playing tennis. You and I just had a match yesterday, didn't
yes,
we? And I won't mention the outcome.
You can mention the score, that's okay.
You know? It was close. We had a fun time, didn't we? I enjoy playing sports with my students. I like playing soccer and tennis, and when there's surf on the Great Lakes, I like to grab that. I've got a surfboard or two from California. But other than that, I enjoy reading and learning about church history, and especially applying the lessons from church history to things happening in the church today. Mm. And I feel it's a privilege to be able to work both as a church historian, but also as a lawyer, advising and counseling church leaders as they're facing problems today. And I think bringing those two worlds together is very helpful and a very interesting thing to do.
Mm. You also wrote a book recently, right? Rather recently?
I did, yes. Yes, a couple of books in the last couple of years on the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. Mm-hmm. One was a book aimed mostly at Adventists, The Reformation and the Remnant, mm-hmm. which had to do with issues in the church relating to church organization and ordination and creation and evolution in the sanctuary, but looked at through the prism of the reformers mm-hmm. in church history. And the second one was aimed more at outsiders, and it focused especially on church and state and religious liberty, which is a specialty of mine. 500 years of protest and liberty from Martin Luther to modern civil rights, and it comes up to the election of Donald Trump, in fact, and talks about the Protestant heritage of our country and what it means for public policy and church and state.
Well, that's definitely some good content. I have read both books, and I can definitely recommend them. So they're very good, and they expand the conversation when it comes to Protestantism and today's environment in America, especially. Well, today we're going to be speaking about the concept or the what's going to be voted over the next couple of days. The General Conference has an annual council. We kind of review a little bit of that on Monday with David Hamstra, but today we're kind of going over a couple of the different things, and mainly some of the sections that are going to be discussed and voted at this annual council. So our audience needs to get maybe a picture. What happens at annual council? So people get there, and what are some of the things that they voted on or they have voted in the past?
Well, it is the most representative church governance body outside of the General Conference session, mm-hmm. which only happens once every 5 years. So it's the yearly gathering of institutional leaders of all the divisions and unions from around the world. Mm-hmm. And so it really is, quite representative of the world church. And in between the gatherings of the annual council, you have, which is considered the executive committee, you have the administrative committee, mm-hmm. which consists just really of the leadership in Silver Spring, the General Conference officers and departmental leaders and vice presidents. So they usually bring recommendations for dealing with issues or problems that have come up during the year mm-hmm. For the larger issues that require the input and decision of the World Church to this annual council. Okay. And so decisions that have been made there over the years include things like, ordaining women elders,
Okay.
Many people don't know that hasn't really been decided directly at a general conference session. That was a decision of an annual council,
mm-hmm.
which appears probably to have been ratified by the general conference at some point, but maybe more indirectly.
Mm-hmm.
So it will deal with fairly serious issues, though not the most serious ones, like changing or adding to doctrinal statements,
mm-hmm.
has to take place at a GC session.
Okay. And on top of that, there's also some more menial things like changes in language or maybe capitalization or commas that need to be introduced.
Yes, but usually they deal with substantive things,
right.
But those of not the highest order,
okay.
more of what you would consider a second order, but still important.
Okay. So what are some of the things, as you have reviewed, as you have seen a couple of the procedures that will occur during this next annual council? The theme is faithfulness to his prophets. What are some of the main votes that will be occurring starting on Sunday?
So, yeah, I was just able to review the fairly detailed agenda and the attached items for action. And there's really three that stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one that has had by far the greatest attention is this question of the compliance committees.
Mm-hmm.
And their role and scope for making sure that there has been compliance with actions taken by the General Conference in session or by the Annual Council. So maybe did you discuss this with David Hamstra in your previous?
We just went over a little bit of the background of how we got to this Annual Council, and there was some mention, but now at the time the document had not been fully released. So now that we have the full document and it's available to the public to review, also the agenda, I went over a couple of things, and we saw this, you know, there's this five, you know, set up committee, right? But it seems to me that it's not clear whether it's activated already or it's not. Is it being recommended? It doesn't seem to be voted into the policy. There's
so,
some discussion.
There's confusion on this point, and the reason there's confusion on this point is because it's been handled in a somewhat confusing manner.
Okay.
There has been an action by the administrative committee already in July and August to create five compliance committees,
mm-hmm.
and populate these committees with names mostly of General Conference employees, a few outside representatives, and that's one part of it, having the committees together and they actually have terms of reference, or references written. But then there's a second part of it, and that is the creation of a larger document or policy, which these committees can then undertake to follow to review the actions of other world church institutions or organizations, and then make recommendations for the disciplining of the leaders of these organizations or mm-hmm. institutions. And it tends to focus on the disciplining of unions, and especially union officers and presidents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason this is unusual is because it seems that the committees themselves have been actually set up and authorized and even perhaps started to operate,
mm-hmm.
whereas the document that talks about the larger disciplinary framework does not appear to have been authorized yet. And in fact, that is on the agenda to be discussed on this coming Sunday, October 14. And there's a note next to it that a vote is to be taken. And it's a vote on, and the name of this document is Regard for and Practice of General Conference Session and General Conference Executive Committee Actions.
So as David and you have said, there's this committee and there's some disciplinary actions. David mentioned something along the lines of giving a public reprimand and, you know, maybe kind of hampering the process for these union officers that are not in compliance. And what I'm kind of confusing for me is, like, how can you approve something that has not been brought to the whole executive committee? Is that a good thing? First, is that maybe not a good thing? It's not the best adjective to use, but is that something positive? Is that something that is that following the process?
Well, it's a strange thing. Usually, you would approve the general process,
mm-hmm.
and then you would, and included in that would be the approval to create these committees.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like that the General Conference administrative leadership has got the cart before the horse. They seem to have assumed that the disciplinary process will be approved, and they've already gone ahead and created the committees on their own authority. And in fact, this document, the Regard for and Practice of General Conference Session, has a asterisk in it when it talks about the compliance committees. Mm-hmm. And that asterisk leads to a note at the bottom that says, as per the General Conference Administrative Committee actions of July and August. So this document proceeds on the assumption that these committees already exist, and yet it's this document that gives a description of, in fact, what these committees are meant to do.
So the committees were created from the administrative committee, which is the highest leadership at the
General Conference officers and vice presidents. Okay. Yes.
So General Conference officers and vice presidents, they created these committees, but they did not bring these committees to be approved by the executive committee.
That's correct.
So to me, that's a problem. This seems to be a fault in the process, like you say.
It's to get the cart before the horse, and I think it's also to take a very important part of this compliance procedure and not allow the executive committee of the annual council to weigh in on it.
Now, the executive committee can just say, we're not going to do this, and reject it.
I think that it should. I think that the administrative council has overstepped itself in setting up these committees ahead of the vote by the executive committee, allowing for the process itself to happen. I think that the kinds of committees you set up are a fundamental part of the fairness and the reasonableness of a larger compliance process, and to take that element of it out and to only have them discuss the larger compliance process and not who's actually carrying it out is to not allow them to make a decision on one of the most fundamentally important parts of the compliance process.
So let me rephrase it in one short sentence. I'm trying to get it so we can kind of move on from this very convoluted process. So the General Conference Administrative Committee has created five compliance review committees, correct, more committees to create. And they also have recommended this process to the executive committee.
Correct.
So the executive committee is voting on what the process looks like, not who is executing the process.
Exactly.
And in your opinion, that is the General Conference Committee, the administrative committee, has overstepped its boundaries.
I think it has, yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's not in terms of, there's no law that they've broken by doing this, but it certainly seems to me against the spirit of the General Conference operating policy, which would, there are existing disciplinary standards in place in operating procedure, and those are clear that unions can be disciplined and reorganized on certain grounds with decisions made by a combination of annual council and General Conference in session. This is an attempt to change that disciplinary process and have a remarkable number of those changes made only by the administrative committee decision and not by annual council or the executive committee.
So it seems to me that the authority to make changes or do these things now, it doesn't reside in the larger executive committee, but it's residing in the smaller group.
Well, it should reside in the larger executive committee.
But according to this documents and processes,
the smaller group has decided who the policemen are going to be, which is a very important, if you're setting up a system of policing, you know, there's two important elements: who's doing the policing and what the procedures are. And both those elements are vital, and the executive committee should decide both of those. But at this point, it's only the administrative committee who's deciding who the policemen are, and the executive committee can weigh in on the process. Well, I think under church policy, the executive committee should be making decisions on both those points.
Okay. That's a very good point. And I think that, well, I invite the delegates who may be listening to this to kind of bring this question into the forum, into the board, to the process, to kind of challenge, because I think this is important what you're saying, that, you know, there's still power to revise and to do these things and to kind of decide how we're going to move forward, because it doesn't seem to be a very united process.
They should object to this. I think that the proposal as it stands invades what are appropriately the prerogatives and responsibilities of the annual council itself. Okay. And I think that part of the reason it's being done is because it keeps the kind of police force as a very small group directly controlled by the general conference. And if the annual council really thought through this, I think the annual council would want a much more representative body of with representation from lower levels in the church, including other unions and at the division level. And that would make for fairer and more balanced. See, I'm not against compliance, but I think that we believe in the priesthood of all believers in the body of Christ, and the compliance needs to come from throughout the body,
right?
Not just the top down.
Just to a certain degree, as Acts 15 occurred, you know, there was some compliance that, you know, they came to a decision, they voted something, and it's like, well, you're not supposed to go prescribe circumcision again.
Right.
You know, we decided that it wasn't, so let's all be on the same page. But there seems to be a little bit more, well, in the apostolic era, there was this diversity of thought and practice to a certain degree. But when once they decided they wanted everybody to comply, and I agree, I don't think there's nothing wrong in compliance. It's just on how we arrive.
How we're going to do that compliance, and is the church going to hold itself accountable, or is a small group at the top going to hold everybody accountable? Mm-hmm. That's a recipe for coercion, for tyranny, and this isn't a jab against the existing leadership, because it's conservative right now. But what if suddenly there was a liberal leadership that some of us didn't like? Then it could impose its particular agenda at every level throughout the church. And it's an unhealthy circumstance to be in. You need a fuller representation of the body of Christ holding the body accountable.
So the accountability, as I hear you say it, shouldn't just come from people at the top. That seems to be a very autocratic and very tyrannical model.
Well, it could evolve into that. Yeah.
But always through the body. The body is. I think you published a article, if I understand correctly.
I did. Not too long ago on the Compass magazine website about trust in the body of Christ.
Okay.
Yes. And I addressed some of these issues there.
Okay. Well, that seems to be one issue that will be voted, and I think that's the most convoluted one.
Yes.
There are two more that you mentioned. We have the voted actions, a change in language, it seems to be, that the document represents. Why is this significant? There seems to be a change in how the relationships between the unions and the divisions occur.
And the conferences.
Yeah.
Well, at each level of our church organization, we have model constitutions.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you create a conference or a union or even a local mission, that the documents you use may differ from place to place, but they're supposed to contain certain elements which are the same. And the constitutions are supposed to reflect and be in compliance, if you will, with the higher documents of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense when you want to have a unified body. And as the language stood, it said that the purposes and policies, and I'm quoting now, the purposes, policies, and procedures of this union conference shall be in harmony with, and it did say, the working policies and procedures of the North American Division and the General Conference.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that language is being changed to say working policies, voted actions, and procedures. So they're wanting to add the language voted actions.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's an attempt to bring in, as a policy of the church, the votes in 1990 and 1995, as well as 2015, regarding the ordination of women. Because those votes weren't technically creating working policies or procedures. They were attempts to perhaps implement a new idea, a new proposal, and those were rejected to ordain women. But they themselves, the votes don't represent policies of the church. So this is a little bit of lawyering to try to make it clear that the unions that are ordaining women are not just acting, are acting contrary to, even if they're technically not acting contrary to church policy, that they're acting contrary to the voted actions that took place.
So what I understand from that is that even though not ordaining women is not part of the policy, like there is no clause right there, the vote and you or anyone going against that vote will be against the church per se. That's the language that they're trying to...
You need to be in compliance. To be honest with you, as a lawyer, I think this is an unnecessary addition because I think that the votes of 90, 95, and 2015, while they're not policies themselves, they're pretty strong evidence that the church considers its policy and it's certainly its practice not to ordain women. So I think this is kind of an unnecessary little bit of lawyering.
Okay.
But
is this maybe, I mean, some people have suggested even, to me it seems a little bit radical, but some people have suggested this idea that this may be if in some case unions continue to be in non-compliance, all of these things get voted on, and eventually this ends up in a court setting. Is it for those purposes, just in case? And then what would the spirit of this imply, that, you know, we don't trust our own? Or,
well, I think that's reading too much into it, because okay. I know at the highest levels that Elder Ted Wilson himself and everyone I've spoken to on down has said there is no plan, intent, or belief that anyone would pursue this in court.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good statement to know, and definitely. Now, there's one more section that you also want to mention.
Right? Right, which is near and dear to my heart, yes.
Yes,
because
very,
it has to do with the seminary.
Yeah, very, very dear to your heart. So what has it been changed about the seminary?
Well, there was a policy, L20, which talked very much about the central role that the Adventist seminaries played in theological education.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't just talk about the Andrews Seminary, but it also talked about the seminary in Africa as well as in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think there have been... maybe there's two seminaries in Africa, and there's some seminaries in South America.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you would imagine this might be revised to reflect the larger group of seminaries that the church was supportive of. But it hasn't been revised in that way. It's been revised to take away almost all mention of seminaries and focus almost exclusively on undergraduate theological education. And it says that it's expected that ministers hired by the church will hold a ministerial degree from a Seventh-day Adventist institution accredited by the Adventist Accrediting Association. And then it goes on to say that it would be helpful and it might be a good thing to get advanced ministerial degrees. But then it generally talks about these giving ministers time off to meet their own, who can meet their own expenses. And it really is silent on the need for advanced degrees, whereas the previous statement had said that it was basically expected that young people seeking full-time employment for the ministry, the general plan would be for them to have a full Master of Divinity curriculum. And I feel that this is a really short-sighted movement away from providing our ministers with a quality higher education.
Hmm.
Especially in the Western world, where standards of education are rising in all professional fields, how is it that we would allow ministers, of all people who should be thought leaders, both spiritual leaders, but also intellectual leaders in their communities, to have lesser education than the people they're ministering to?
Hmm.
You know, this is completely opposite of what the pioneers of spirituality in America pursued. If you think of the Pilgrims and the Puritans, the ministers were generally the leading intellectuals in the community. Yale, Harvard, Dartmouth, Columbia, all these Ivy League schools were established to, first of all, provide intellectual training and biblical training for ministers.
Mm.
And they were the thought leaders, the leaders of the first and the second Great Awakening. Yes, people, God can use anyone, and there were plowmen and uneducated women who were ministers and preachers. But the ones who really led out and who created the framework within which the others were ministering were generally ministers and professors, ministers often with master's and even PhD degrees, who preached from their pulpits, but who were deeply educated historically, theologically, and biblically. And, you know, nowhere does Ellen White's clear on the need for our young people and ministers to pursue theological training and education. And it's just a disappointing step backwards to sort of say, well, now an undergraduate education is generally sufficient and, you know, it becomes permissive or discretionary as to whether to get a more advanced degree.
Hmm. So there seems to be a move towards, well, get your four-year degree, but that's not necessary for you. It's not necessary for you to go to get your MDiv or master's or PhD. So there seems, as you say, is discouraged. Is not encouraged overtly
as it was. I don't know if I would say discouraged so much as it's no longer encouraged.
Okay, it's no longer encouraged. Will that, is that a problem? Is that a problem, or does that allow us to be maybe more open to, you know, quote unquote, some people will say, unnecessary time at the seminary? Is I mean, you teach at the seminary, therefore you will see this as an attack? Is this an attack? Is this a saying, well, 4 years is enough and that's all you're going to need?
I think it's deeply problematic. I'm not saying that 3 full years is necessary for everyone. In fact, we've just been revising the curriculum so mm-hmm. that if you have an undergraduate degree in theology, you can come and do the MDiv in 2 years. Mm. Or maybe it's a summer over 2 years.
Yes.
So it's a relatively shortened process. And then you can do your DMin while you're continuing to work in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good. I don't think we want to pull pastors out of the field beyond that 2 or 3 year period. But look, when you go to churches today where there are educated people, you know, it's assumed in our society, at least among the educated groups, that the undergraduate degree is just the start, right? Mm-hmm. People have the MBAs and the masters in social work and the masters in education, and they've got if they don't have doctorates and PhDs of various kinds, mm-hmm. and you're dealing with lawyers and doctors, and you're only going to have a 4-year degree. You know, how are you going to deal at the level of sophistication that your church members are achieving in our society that's so educational oriented? And of course, we don't want to make a god or an idol out of education. But look at the great reformers of the church, from Paul himself, or Augustine, or Calvin, or Luther, or Wesley, or all of these guys had advanced education, some of them, many of them, doctorates, and they were the ones that changed the worlds and brought revival to the church of their time.
As a part of this change that is occurring when it comes to the seminary, is this a move towards, is there a mention of necessary theological education within an accredited institution? Or is this more opening the door towards conferences hiring from Bible colleges and not encouraging to hire or necessarily hire from the MDiv candidates that may be?
Yes, I think that's a good observation. It's clear that the entry level, it's expected that that the degree, the undergraduate degree, will be from an accredited Adventist institution. But the advanced ministerial degree merely says, recommended that conferences, missions, and other institutions make provisions for giving employees the privilege of formal advanced ministerial education in light of their aptitude and promise. So this formal advanced ministerial education is a very vaguely worded mm-hmm. phrase, which certainly could mean many things, any number of things, outside of a formal seminary setting.
And that definitely detriments from enrollment at the seminary, and will detriment from our institutional procedure that we have had for many years to send people to come here and interact. Because another part of coming to the seminary is not necessarily only the education that you're getting, it's the networking that occurs here. And for example, I have had the privilege to not only meet professors, but also meet people that I know I'll have connections for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So I think that that's also another portion that it's discouraged in this sense. Like, you go for 4 years, but you're not going to have that professional experience. Once people come here, they come with professional experience, expanding ideas. And so,
yeah, well said. Well said. I think it, you know, let's be candid. I think this has to do with some of the tensions that have been between the seminary and the General Conference leadership over the last few years. The seminary leadership has generally been favorable and supportive of women's ordination, to somewhat to the chagrin and unhappiness of the General Conference leadership. So I think we're seeing a response in a very practical way to that.
Now, as far as this point goes, what will be your recommendation? And maybe you want to touch on the other two points as we start closing out on the podcast. What will be your recommendation for delegates that will be voting on, especially this point that's really dear to your heart, and the two other points that I have mentioned?
So, well, maybe we'll work backwards. I think on the ministerial educational front, that this new emphasis should not be accepted in the Western industrialized world. Certainly, we need to be advancing our pastors and ministerial candidates to higher levels of education, and I think this is just a rather profound mistake. Perhaps the existing language does need to be tweaked to allow it to reflect the fact that there are now multiple seminaries that can provide this education, but let's not put the emphasis and focus back just on the undergraduate level. On the second issue relating to policies and procedures versus voted actions, I don't have strong feelings about that one way or the other. I think that's legal penmanship. I think it's fine as it reads, but if it changes, it wouldn't ruin my world or anyone else's, I don't think. Okay. But as far as the first and perhaps most important point, I believe that there should be a rejection of both sides of this compliance document. I think that the committees themselves are too narrow and too non-representative of the world church. There needs to be a more flexible system of committees put into place that would have different membership depending on what institution or level of church organization was being examined. And there should be representation from the sister fields of that institution so that they're closer to the situation and would know what the truth of the matter is and what the problems are being faced. So this police force, as I earlier mentioned out, I think it's the wrong police force, not that the people on it are bad or have any ill intent in any way, but they're simply not close enough to the situation on the ground, at least potentially. Certainly you want representation at the GC level, but you want it throughout. And I also think that the procedure document that they are being asked to vote on is flawed in that it seeks to discipline unions by taking away their representation at the General Conference and Annual Council level without going through the procedures that are required in an existing operating policy to actually discipline a union. Hmm. Now, it may be that those procedures themselves are too extreme. You probably shouldn't have to go to a General Conference in session to hold a union accountable. Maybe that needs to be modified, but the annual council should choose to modify it in a way which gives greater procedural protections than are found in this document. So I'm hopeful that our delegates will push back against the existing committees, which they haven't been asked about. They should challenge the administration, of course, respectfully and kindly, but firmly, that the creation of these committees is to put the cart before the horse, and that these committees shouldn't be operating, certainly, or even be recognized until the annual council has decided on a procedure to follow. Then it can discuss who's going to carry out that procedure.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Miller.
Good. And my prayers are with the delegates and with all of you, the leadership of the General Conference. I know everyone has good intentions, and I'm not calling that into question at all. But I think in some instances, zeal has overrun careful, reflective judgment on the way some of these things are being handled.
All right. Well, thank you very much again and for your time for discussing these very important issues. If you can give us one more sentence, we always like to give our guests the final word, so go ahead.
Well, I think that I want my final word to be that the final word in between General Conference sessions should lie with the Annual Council on these important matters.
That was our discussion on the votes and important matters that the delegates will be discussing over this year's annual council. We thank Dr. Nicholas Miller for providing us this opportunity and for explaining a little bit of the more convoluted topics. Thank you for listening today. We appreciate that you have taken the time to listen to our podcast and ask that you share it with others. Please leave a review on iTunes or your favorite podcatching app. If you're enjoying our content, we want to invite you to consider contributing to our cause by becoming a Patreon, where you will receive exclusive content, have the ability to sit down with the Disruptive Adventism team, and ask relevant questions for Adventism and society. If you're interested in contributing, head to patreon.com/disruptiveadventism. Another avenue for contribution is to purchase our merchandise through Amazon or tpublic.com. You can find the links for merchandise on our Facebook or Instagram pages. We also hope that our content has intrigued you a little bit and that you decide to stay around for future podcasts. If you have any comments, feedback, or a topic you would like us to discuss, please go to our website at www.disruptiveadventism.org or shoot us an email to disruptiveadventism@gmail.com. We're eager to engage in discussions about any matter, so don't hesitate to contact us. This has been it for today. We hope you join us next time. And as always, we invite you to be disruptive.